Thank you very much, Professor Kellner. And I believe you still have some time for questions, about 13 minutes, and that should suffice. So please do not hold back and get something more of the original lecture that we might have missed.
You've impressed everybody too much.
If there are none, I can just continue lecturing, or we can go have the reception.
Thank you for the talk. The question is, Tom, when we left this, I'm wondering...
Slowly. Beketzev hachtava.
Let me start over again. In the introduction, the first chapter, the laws of prayer, Maimonides lays out, does he not, an answer to the question, or another answer to the question that you raised. In other words, he's distinguished from Maimonides by teaching us that it is a positive commandment to pray.
Right.
Maimonides doesn't say that. He then opens up the laws of prayer by telling us that, in fact, there was a time where people prayed spontaneously, i.e. perhaps they even meditated. The only thing that they shared in common was the direction that they faced. He then takes us through an historical process by which that capacity was lost. And so he offers an answer, grounded in history, does he not?
Yeah. Absolutely. That's one of the texts I didn't read today. But let me just recapitulate. Maimonides says that originally Jews worshipped God each in her or his own way, not necessarily by saying anything. The worship could have been just a worshipful stance before God, metaphorically before God. But when the Jews were exiled to Babylonia and they lost both the ability to speak pure, correct Hebrew, and also became deteriorated in terms of their abilities to express even themselves in thinking, then Ezra and his court established a set liturgy. So that's Maimonides' excuse for why there is a set liturgy. But the point I was trying to make is, okay, we now have a set liturgy. Why is it permanent? If the set liturgy is an accommodation to an unfortunate historical circumstance, what happens when history becomes more fortunate? There is no indication in any of Maimonides' writings that he expects in the days of the Messiah synagogues to disappear. Maybe rabbinic sermons, but not the synagogues. So that was the point I was trying to make. The set liturgy becomes set and permanent, even though it's a concession to an historical circumstance. And that was the question. I don't have a wonderful answer, but that's certainly the question I was trying to push forward. Yeah?
So I could just focus this with an image of spontaneous prayer. It also forces us to live liturgy when the that's inscribed in the same Malachic...
Start again, I didn't hear the first...
Notice the treatise on prayer begins with this image of a lost ideal.
Right.
And you're told that we're stuck in one answer to the question again, as you put it, and maybe implicit in the text, namely, it is indeed the character of the Jewish people, conditioned by history, that not everyone will be able to pray at the same level. And so in the interest of keeping this a prayerful people, this liturgy is a tragic necessity born of history.
I absolutely...
And the Messiah doesn't redeem it.
I absolutely agree with you, and that's the question.
Yeah.
If this is a tragic necessity born of unfortunate history, why is it permanent? Logically, one would think, just like one would think that sacrifices should not be offered in the Messianic era because they were a concession to paganism. And yet Maimonides insists that they will be. I mean, the simplest response is to say, well, he was kidding. You know, in a more serious fashion. He had an esoteric teaching and he did not really expect... I'm going to break... This thing is going to kill me before. But I personally try to get to that kind of answer only as a last resort. Especially in the case of sacrifices, he didn't have to open his discussion of the Messiah with the very first sentence says, the Messiah will arise, the Messiah will build the temple and reinstitute the sacrificial cult. He didn't have to say that. So that's why I don't... It's another reason why I don't like to say, well, he was kidding. In a more serious fashion than kidding.
Well, Last question, I'm only taking advantage of the fact that other hands didn't go up swiftly, and that is, if you say any meaning in the order of the tractates, for example, that it ends with circumcision, the Book of Love ending with the sign on the organ of love. Yeah.
That's pretty cute. That's the kind of play on words that I don't think would work in Rambam's Hebrew. I don't know. I've actually given some thought to that question and have not come up with any particularly good answer. I had to write an introduction to the translation. That was one of the things I tried to figure out, but I don't know. I will say one thing about it. He has something interesting there in the discussion of circumcision, totally irrelevant to your question. But he's the first person, and perhaps one of the few, last persons, to point out that the commandment of circumcision occurs exactly 13 times in the text around the story of Abraham. And the number 13 is significant for Maimonides. And I want to say here, not only because of the 13 principles of faith, and not only because my office in Eshkol Tower at the University of Haifa is 1313, which is, I think, very appropriate for a person who works with Rambam, but it's also appropriate, and here we're getting into Straussian numerology, because of the laws of the Jubilee year, chapter 13, section 13, which is the precise midpoint of the Mishneh Torah, and it is the most universalistic statement ever found in a halachic text written by a Jew till this point that I've ever heard of. And so I think one, circumcision and its current uniqueness to Jews, but the ultimate universality implicit in laws of laws of Jubilee or 1313. But that's, I usually don't try to use Strauss, but here it's just like begging.
I'd like to, if permitted, stray a little bit from spiritual philosophy to political philosophy, because I know you've written and thought about that throughout your career as well. On the one hand, we have thinkers on the right who seem to draw a somewhat straight line from Aristotle to Maimonides to Aquinas to Strauss, ending up with Paul Wolfowitz, perhaps with a detour to Clarence Thomas and the development of natural law. On the other hand, we have people such as the late Professor Leibovitz, who clearly utilizes Maimonides as an argument against rampant messianism in contemporary Israel. What can we say about a thinker whose writings can be used so disparately by such a wide range of a contemporary political thought? Does this leave him devoid of any real meaning, or are all these interpretations correct, or is the truth someplace in your Aristotelian middle, in your opinion?
I'm glad you added that last codicil. In my opinion, let me start off by saying I try not to tell people what Maimonides would have said about contemporary political issues. Both because I don't remember exactly when he told me, Kellner, you may speak in my voice. And also because we deal with writings written in the 13th century which reflect a particular historical, political, social, cultural, philosophical, religious reality. And to take those writings and try to understand what their author would say in our reality, I think is really irresponsible. So I try to, I'm not criticizing your question, but I think that it's not a fair question to ask. People who use Maimonides explicitly in that fashion, we all do it to one extent or another, ought to be much more careful. Now, you asked about my own opinion. My own opinion is that the importance of Maimonides has nothing to do with Leo Strauss and Paul Wolfowitz and the war in Iraq. And I have literally no idea what one could derive from his philosophical writings that would lead to a position on those issues. I think it's much too complex and involves much too much interpretation to go in any meaningful way from Rambam to Rumsfeld. It just it doesn't work. But I think that where it does work, and maybe I'm just reflecting my own stance here, I can't be sure that I'm not. I think where it does work is when you try and understand the implications of Maimonides for contemporary debates within Judaism, or contemporary debates about policy issues in Israel where these policy issues reflect attitudes towards, say, the land of Israel. And if I said before that let me just put in the following words. As I understand him, this is the subject of my ongoing research, Maimonides sees halakha, Jewish law, as constituting institutional reality, but never as reflecting antecedent ontological reality. In other words, if something is holy, look, we have here two bottles, and if I say that this one is holy and this one is profane, what am I saying? Not profane, but not secular. What's the word? Mundane, whatever. Common. Not holy, okay? What's the difference between them? Well, Maimonides is among the few figures in the history of Judaism who would say there is no difference between these two bottles. The difference is in the way in which Jews are commanded to behave with respect to these bottles. In other words, the difference is purely institutional. And that's a big difference because this institution was given by God at Sinai, according to Maimonides. So it's not some kind of convention that society determined or laws passed by a legislature, right? But there is nothing in the nature of these bottles which distinguishes them. Almost every other medieval and modern, almost every other medieval and up to the very modern era Jewish thinker and halakhist said no. There is something inherent in the universe. This is holy, this is not holy, and they're actually in these bottles. Well, Maimonides, those positions, when you translate them to questions concerning the land of Israel, immediately bring you into political positions. So that there, I think it makes a lot of sense to try and drag Maimonides into the fight. But the bigger questions of neocons versus others, I think he's too far away.
And do you think that's what Professor Leibovitz is attempting to do in his writings on Maimonides?
No, I don't think so. I know so. That's absolutely what he was trying to do.
Is there any connection, you think, between Maimonides' thought about God and the fact that Islam had reached India, it seems to me to be a similarity in the levels that one can reach, sort of what is common in the thought processes that have been described today for Maimonides. And I know that Raphael Rikai has done that with the Kabbalah. He said there is Hindu origins for the Kabbalah, but it's true or not, I certainly am no expert. But it seemed to me that you're striving, loving, you're going to reach a higher and higher level, has very great similarities. The Hindu, it seeks to mortify themselves, they go off and they try to reach calmer, so they don't have to keep the internal cycle of life going on.
Let me respond for a change briefly. With two short comments. The first is, I have no idea about any possible historical connection or influence between Indian thought and Maimonides. But more importantly, I think we should all bear in mind that people are people. And it would be surprising if there weren't commonalities in the way in which human beings react to the world in which they live. So that if you have people who have a basically religious orientation to the universe, it's not surprising if they more or less arrive at parallel or similar or views that seem to be in some sense in sync. I think it would be surprising if they didn't, because and in this I'm expressing Maimonides' idea deriving from Aristotle that people are people. There's a lot of commonality among human beings.
Well, I want to thank all our speakers.
Do you see
No, I don't know what else if he's here. Before we conclude the formal part of this conference, I think we need to acknowledge some of the organizations that made this conference possible. And these are the Program in Jewish